This is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live with a real treat today. Some of you may have heard Andrew Lamb as a guest on Love Letters Live before. Andrew, well, I'm going to really turn it over to you. I want you to tell people where you're from and a little bit of your history and what you do.
Yeah.
And then let's talk about your work.
Okay. Well, I'm originally from Vietnam. I came to the United States in 1975 at the end of the war. I was a biochemist.
I have a question about that.
Yeah.
I hope this isn't just really a dim-witted slash rude question. But, you know, in this country, people hear Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And they think war.
Yeah.
They think Vietnam is the title of a war.
Yeah.
And I think it's only now
that
people are realizing it's a country with culture
and beauty.
Well, now
they think Vietnam as the major destination because Condé Nast decides it's one of the top 10 places to visit.
But
for years, it's a metaphor for America's defeat,
mm-hmm.
you know? When you think about it, it ended in 1975.
When you said that, I just realized,
And so it's almost 37 years now. And so we shouldn't hold a country captive to that kind of memory, you know?
Or define a country by a war.
Or define by the war. Because if you think about it, you go to Vietnam and, you know, the population had increased from 1975 from 30 million people
mm-hmm.
to 92 million people. I know, it's a lot of people, but it also tells you...
On the whole
planet,
there's...
Yeah, but it also tells you that 2 out of 3 have no memory of the Vietnam War.
Oh, yes, good
point. You
know? So, and here also, I'm sure, good.
If you ask your kid how they, you know, like 19-year-old kid, how he feels about Watergate, and he say, what the hell are you talking about, right? So why should we hold those population that are same age... you know, captive to our memory of the war.
Oh, that's an interesting point, yes.
That's
why old folks are old folks.
Yeah,
they
but
keep...
I guess I'm one of those old folks that was old enough, you know, at age 11 to remember the war. And so it became sort of the touchstone of my life in a
because
way.
Because you saw it around you?
Well, yeah, my father was in the military, so I was an army brat.
Yes.
And so in some way I'm haunted by memory of the war. And not only that, but the aftermath in which people escape and die, you know, as both people, as you may recall.
Yes.
And so in a way, you know, my first book, Perfume Dreams, was a kind of what the French call cri de cœur, you know, cry of the heart, because it's a way to exorcise that survivor's guilt, you know.
Uh-huh.
And that's... but, you know, I started writing in 1990, 91.
Well, you said you started out in biochemistry.
Yeah, so Berkeley. I went to Berkeley.
Why don't you reiterate how your parents responded to
you remember that conversation.
I sure do.
Well, my mom was very upset, and she said, I knew it, sending you to Berkeley was a mistake because you have become a hippie. And my dad was, you know, very practical, and he said, well... name for me a Vietnamese who's making a living as a writer, because I came home and say, I'm not going to be a doctor, I'm going to be a writer after I graduate from Berkeley. And so, you know, I couldn't name one because the diaspora since 1975 was quite young in 1990 when, you know, I decided to write.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't name one, but I told my father that I'm going to be the first, which to him seemed very cheeky, as he thought.
Yes.
But, you know, but then when I said that, I realized now I'm in for it, right? Because you cannot go backward, so I have to go forward. And so I started
writing. You have no desire to go backward.
No, anyway. Not at all.
Yes. You're one of the most modern people I've ever met.
Thank you.
Yes. So talk about this book.
Okay. Well, after Perfume Dreams, I wrote East Eats West, and it's a little bit more optimistic, as you may recall.
Yeah.
And it's more looking at how, in my lifetime in America, Asian culture started to change the West.
Yes.
From cuisine to anime to Buddhism to, you know, martial arts and
everything
else.
I think you made a point also, I'm sure it was you, about going into a restaurant.
Yeah.
An Asian restaurant, and if you don't pick up chopsticks in San Francisco...
You're not San Franciscan.
Oh, you're such a dork.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, most of my non-Asian friends use chopsticks, and they find that if tourists don't know how to use chopsticks, they're the one that get upset.
Uh-huh.
Because they say, how can you not know how to use chopsticks? In a sense, chopsticks become the meme, the universal usage, like a fork now, at least if you're in the West Coast, you know? But so I thought how interesting in my lifetime in America, things have changed so much. But the new book, Birds of Paradise Lost, is really about, you know, how one goes from that trauma of having escaped Vietnam to readjusting yourself to American life and become cosmopolitan within the same lifetime.
But was your family, I mean, every country has its cosmopolitan.
Yeah. Well, my family was cosmopolitan, but this is book of fiction, so it's not about my family.
Okay, but you talk talked about coming here and becoming.
Yeah, sure. But so Birds of Paradise is really about conquering a lot of lives who were not necessarily cosmopolitan in Vietnam, people who escaped from the rice field.
I see.
And then suddenly become a restaurant owner in San Francisco and yet still have memories of being haunted by the war and so on.
There's one story in here.
Yeah.
That was so gripping. I must confess, I thought they were true stories.
Yeah. No,
that's how good
fiction.
They are.
Thank you.
Yes. I don't know, this is kind of an odd thing to say, but the story about the man, the American who kept wanting to be accepted as a Vietnamese.
Yes, it's called Slingshot, and it's based here in San Francisco, Tenderloin, in fact. Basically, it's about this two sisters and their mother who run this restaurant in the Tenderloin, and they're Vietnamese. And there's this American Vietnam vet who tries so hard to be part of that family, you know.
Why?
Because, you know, Americans are lonely.
Oh, yes. Okay.
You know,
and
he's divorced.
That's the family and his...
And to him, that's the family that he wants to belong to. So he's a regular. That happens a lot of time. I sit in the Tenderloin and I see a lot of loners who go back to the same restaurant and have conversation. You just buy a coffee.
Oh, everybody wants to have a family.
They want to be part of that. So
so
in a way, that's the norm. And I find it's really interesting how this Vietnamese family becomes sort of the pillar of this guy's society, you know? Mm-hmm. Someone who fought the Vietnam War and never really fully come back, and the only comfortable place is a Vietnamese restaurant in the Tenderloin, you know? And so that kind of narrative I find really interesting, you know? So... it's told from the younger sister's voice, and I just hear it so clearly, you know. So that's why I write these stories, basically.
Do you want to tell us about some of your other stories?
Yeah.
Well, also tell us a website where people can buy this book.
Of course, it's on Amazon, but you know, but it's published by Red Hen Press in Los Angeles, a boutique publishing house.
Red Hen,
like red chicken.
Yes.
Hen.
Okay. So, and Birds of Paradise Lost at Amazon.
At Amazon. Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
And basically, the 13 stories collected here is kind of if you were talking about love letter, in a way, I step back and I think, oh, there's a cable car going in the background. But I think in a way, it's a love letter to San Francisco, because San Francisco has been my home since I left Vietnam.
And you were, again, how old when you got here?
11.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so in a way it becomes sort of my second home, and it has been generous. It's been hospitable and it's been welcoming. And in a way, you know, I love San Francisco like a country itself, you know? And so all these
characters... You say it's been welcoming. I think... It is generally, and I think people here are very nice.
Yeah.
But you have to bother to be nice also. I mean, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So what do you do to bring out its welcoming?
You know, I'm not quite sure what I do, but I felt that even in seventh grade, the first English teacher was welcoming and caring, my first English teacher, and I didn't speak a word of English. Okay. When I missed the bus, he would drive me home, you know, and I had really good friends. I fell into a really group of good friends who were like sort of nerdy kids, but really smart, and they're like the library gang, as they call themselves, and so they took me in, you know, so I felt very protected, very welcome. And so in a way... My life in America started off in a very good start, you know, and I just sort of took it and run, you know.
What did you do with memories of Vietnam when you were a child and you were just first here?
Yeah, well, when I first came, I was so traumatized by the loss of Vietnam and the refugee experience.
Can you talk about that a little
bit?
Yeah,
I mean, I talk about that in Perfume Dreams a lot. Uh-huh. But basically, I pretended I was American-born.
Yes. Yeah.
I pretended that I was not from Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And within 2 years, you know, my English got good enough that I pretended I was American-born. And when someone say, wow, were you born here? I say, yes, you know, because I didn't want to be part of that sad story of being a refugee, of being, you know, people who were ragged and lived at, you know, at the mercy of charity donations and that sort of thing. So I pretended I was from this Chinese middle class family, you know, and I didn't speak Vietnamese, you know. Of course, I spoke Vietnamese. I just stopped speaking it.
Yes.
And it took me years before I realized you cannot escape that past. It's your past, you know. But for the first
and
five,
also
6 years,
a lot of what is there is your culture and what's made you,
yeah, who you are.
Right.
But I think to integrate for a child in America,
oh yeah, children don't want to be different.
Yeah,
period.
And so you just want to be part of the new society.
Right.
So I changed my name. My Vietnamese name was Yung, you know, which is really hard to say.
Say it again.
Yung.
Yeah.
So I just say, well, call me Andrew. Right.
Uh-huh,
so I became very Americanized very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But at a certain point in your life, you started to look backward, you know, and then you're like, oh my God, all these things I missed, you know, about my life. And I can't just pretend I'm American born. I was born in Vietnam. I saw the war. I saw a lot of atrocities. I saw a lot of beauties.
Mm-hmm.
So I need to tell that story,
yes.
You know, and in some way I continue to do so.
I'm interested in that the children's painful, mm-hmm. Transition.
Yeah.
But you're such a probably innately cheerful human being. Yes? Which
yeah.
is why the English teacher wants to drive you
yeah.
home. People want to hang out with you. I love it when I'm sitting here with you. But yes, I think children don't want to be different. And I'm
yeah.
wondering when you say in a heavily accented voice,
yeah.
no, I was born in America.
Yeah.
Other children say, oh, okay. Because they don't really care.
Yeah. Yeah. If you share common interests. Like, for instance, my friend started joining a karate club.
Mm-hmm.
So I was part of the karate club. We played softball, we played football, you know, and so we were part of the sports thing. And then,
mm-hmm.
so no one cares once you're part of the team. You know what I mean?
Yes.
No one cares about your past once you're part of the team and you're just a regular Joe or a regular Andrew in this case, you know. And I wanted that. I wanted not to stand out. You know,
mm.
you don't want to be called refugee kid.
Well, that's the big issue, yes. You don't want people taking pity on you.
Yeah.
They're looking at you, whoever won the war.
Yeah.
You're still looked at somehow as a loser
yeah.
of something.
And also you're marked by violence and all these kids, you know, in 1975, they saw the war on TV.
Oh, every night at dinner.
Yeah.
It was vile.
And so I was one of those people who
oh.
basically emerged from the TV screen into their lives,
good
right?
point, yes.
And so at the beginning, it was very hard to escape that because they all wanted to know if I saw dead bodies. And
oh,
I, you know, that sort of
I
thing.
See.
So,
I see.
So in a way,
so
I
So that
say,
threw you back into that mess.
Yeah, and so uh-huh. I had to deal with that. But then afterwards, I put it away,
yes,
you know.
Uh-huh.
In fact, one of the stories in this book called Show and Tell is about
oh.
the new kid in the...
Tell us about... Do you
yeah.
want to read us a little bit?
Sure, if I can find it.
Okay.
But Show and Tell is about the kid in the classroom. And he basically got into the classroom and there's a teacher. So basically, it's a little bit biographical, yeah, autobiographical.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll just read a couple paragraphs so you can have an idea.
I'd like to.
And it's told from the point of view of one of the regular kids watching the
oh,
new kid coming
okay.
in. So, Mr. K brought in the new kid near the end of the semester during what he called oral presentations and everybody else called seventh grade show and tell. This is Cao Long Ding, he said, and he's from Vietnam. And immediately, mean old Billy said, cool. And what's so cool about that? Kevin, who sat behind him, asked. And Billy said, idiot, don't you know anything? That's where my dad came back from with this big old scar on his chest and a
mm.
bunch of grossed out stories. And that's where they have helicopters and guns and VCs and all this crazy
oh.
shit. Billy would have gone on, but Mr. K said, be quiet, Billy. So basically,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's the narrative of the entrance for the Vietnamese kid in America.
yeah, I guess there's got to be an art to kind of living down your past while still living up to it.
Yeah, it's kind of weird dichotomy. You know, I think James Baldwin said it in a way. I'm have to paraphrase because I don't remember what
mm-hmm.
he said exactly. But he said, you know, who can history is wrapped in you, and you are wrapped in history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no one can really escape it. So if you can't escape your history, then you should do the next best thing, which is tell your history.
Yes, it's got to be healthier anyway. You know, I see. I think one of the things that happens with so many immigrant groups,
yeah.
and we are all immigrant groups
yeah.
at some point, is that in our parents' zeal
yeah.
to give us what they didn't have,
mm-hmm.
they forget to give us what they did have.
Yeah.
And then you've got to search it out yourself.
Sure.
I mean, I don't know, what were your parents like once you moved here?
Yeah, my parents are a little bit exceptional in that they didn't hesitate to tell the story of Vietnam to the family. But a lot of other Vietnamese families I know the memory of Vietnam was so painful that they stopped telling, which is very typical.
Yes,
there's a lot of immigrants from Europe during World War II that they stopped telling, you know, their children don't know anything about concentration camps or anything like that because they just clammed up, right?
They pretend they're someone else. They pretend they're someone else, not someone the world wants dead. I mean, that's hard to live with.
Yeah. It's hard to live with, but you're also curious because there are behavior from your parents who obviously have post-traumatic stress syndrome, and you don't know why because they don't talk about the horror that they experience. And I talk to
Vietnamese
kids. So
they're just weird.
They just acted weird to
you.
Yes,
right.
Yeah. But a lot of kids, they come up to me in college now when I go around and give talks. It's like, my parents don't tell me anything. I don't know anything about Vietnam. And so I have to learn about it in history books.
Mm-hmm.
And and so when they read my work, they were very grateful because they started to have insights on their own parents because their parents never communicate with them. And also there is an issue of language because a lot of these parents have children who grew up here who don't speak Vietnamese very well. And the parents, on the other hand, don't speak English very well. And so they don't have that much of a sort of a bridge way in which they can tell you the whole story of their escape or the horror of Vietnam or the beauty of Vietnam. You know what I mean?
What is the beauty of Vietnam? What
I mean,
is that?
You know, there's a lot. I mean, like, it's New Year, like this last week and this week. You know, Vietnam celebrates New Year like no other country. I mean, we really celebrate, you know, Lunar New Year. And it would be, like, really exciting time for kids, you know. And, and unlike in the U.S., in Vietnam, kids are allowed to gamble during that time. So kids are playing cards and, you know, the firecrackers. And, you know, so there's a lot of good memory I have of Vietnam during the holiday festivals and so on.
How long a celebration is it?
You know, in Vietnam, I think you get, like, 2 weeks off just to celebrate
for the
New Year.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's pretty
as opposed
fun.
To America, where you have one night of debauchery.
Yeah, exactly, and then go to work with a hangover the next day.
Yes.
Yeah.
And what does the New Year represent?
The New Year, well,
in other words,
obviously,
why in Asian countries it's 2 weeks and it's an ongoing thing.
Yeah. Well, actually, it has to do the lunar calendar sort of coincide with crops. So for a lot of these countries, farming ends a few months or weeks before the lunar calendar begins, the new one. So basically the crops is done, right? So you harvest it, now you rest. Because farming in Vietnam is like 80% of population do farming for a long time. So it's back-breaking work, you know. And so the new crop won't get planted for another 3 weeks.
So you have a
weeks.
Natural time where you can
you
celebrate.
You can really celebrate, and then it's
and
also
rest.
The new year. So so it's sort of like you relax, you go visit relatives, you go home, you know, you see family, and you don't have to do this back-breaking work for a month, right? So there's a natural cycle to why the Lunar New Year is so big in Asia.
Tell us what else you do, because when you're in your office, the writing you do, and I'm so interested in the
I'm an
modern
editor with New American Media.
Yes, tell us what that is.
Which is a website that basically has its own original content, but we also aggregate content from ethnic community media, for instance, Chinese papers, Tsingtao or La Opinion in L.A., or, you know.
What do you do with it?
We translate it if it's in language. Or if it's not, then we just sort of put them on our website and syndicate them so that people can see how the news are happening within those communities, as opposed to reading the Chronicle, which won't tell story of Vietnamese celebrating.
So it's in any community.
Yeah, ethnic community. Uh-huh. So in a way, it's an association of ethnic media around the country.
Oh.
Yeah, so it gives you a different way of looking at news. Mm-hmm. Than, say, mainstream, which is not doing a good
job. And are people gravitating towards that? They want to do
well,
it?
A lot of other, what's so encouraging is to see one ethnic newspaper take news from another community to share with, because, for instance, if you read a Chronicle, you cannot find out what's happening with, like, Vietnamese in Silicon Valley.
Right.
But if you read the Chinese paper, they might pick up the story from Nguyen Viet paper and put it in their paper and say, oh, look, the Vietnamese are also celebrating Chinese New Year.
So what you have in common.
So we have a kind of horizontal kind of narrative in which you say, oh, other ethnic communities are doing this. You wouldn't find that necessarily if you just read mainstream papers. So so it gives you a more complex narrative of what's happening around the country.
A friend of mine just bought and is running a newspaper in Los Angeles called La Minionda.
So it's an ethnic paper.
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah, he should definitely join us because then we can share.
Oh, okay. I'm gonna introduce you.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah.
And so the people who would ordinarily read the Chronicle are not the ones who come to you?
Well, I mean,
or do you not know?
I don't know who comes to us, yeah. But you know, people now are not reading news the way they used to, meaning that they don't go to one website. They might Google a story.
Oh, yes. Of course, I do that all the time.
Yeah, yes. So that whatever they're interested in might show up in any website mm-hmm. that might be relevant to them. For instance, the media exploded over Russia last Friday.
Yes.
You know, if you enter media, Russia explosion, you never know which website going to deliver the best story.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
Yes,
so I don't know if people go to the Chronicle or go to us, but they certainly go to certain stories.
Well, I think that's right. You don't count on the...
Yeah.
Right. I know. It's a wonderful world with Google.
Yeah. So it's kind of flat. You know, like everyone has a good opportunity of showing.
And
their
by the
content.
Way, even how that has changed the language, you know, to Google someone for a long time. I mean, that's just been its own word.
All kinds of. So much has changed. Technology has changed and, you know, content has changed, you know, which makes it kind of difficult to publish a book these days.
Because, in what way?
Because, you know, people expect content to be free.
Yeah. Oh, I see what you're saying.
And so a lot of publishing houses don't publish a lot of books because they're not selling as well as, say, a few 10 years ago. And so to be published these days seems to be of a, you know, a minor miracle in a way. You know?
Necessary?
Huh?
Is it necessary?
Publish a book?
Yes.
I think so. I mean...
I like books.
People
but
kept
I like
asking
the feel.
For Kindle, and there will be a Kindle version of Birds of Paradise mm-hmm. Lost. But at first, it has to be printed for me.
Okay, so let's talk about that for a minute, because I'm going to segue into one of my favorite subjects, which is, of course, anything and love letters.
Yeah.
And so you're talking about you want to see something in paper. You don't want to see it just on a screen.
Yeah. People were making jokes, you know, they say, do you want to autograph my Kindle? You know, I'm like, I don't even know what you're talking about.
Oh, well, right. Yeah, that's nice. That's very sweet that you don't know what they're talking about. But also, the fact that they ask you for an autograph.
Yeah.
Can we just talk about that? What does that mean to you?
Well, and people feel very connected to personal...
Handwriting.
Uh-huh. Like something that's textual and sensual.
Yes.
You know?
And something that you have touched.
Yeah.
That
you know, and I bet you that, you know, content online may disappear, but a book that you keep could last for 100 years. You know?
More than that.
Yeah. Easily.
I mean, I say the same thing about letters. You know, technology changes. Yeah. And this was brought to my attention some time ago. That occurred to me that people will do videos of themselves and, you know, you can't play your Betamax. I don't know if you know what that is.
I do.
But you can't buy a machine anymore that plays a VCR.
Yeah.
And Blu-ray, VHS, by the time I finish the sentence, there'll be something else.
Yeah, yeah, but
it changes.
Yeah.
So whatever's on here is lost.
Sure. And, you know, I have to
these,
say...
These, we have love. We have letters that are 400 years old, and they look as good as the day they were written.
And still, you know, content are still being discovered by famous people all, you know, over... And, you know, in some way, it's interesting. A friend of mine said that, you know, just because we're not in the Stone Age anymore, that doesn't mean we're out of stones, you know?
Yeah.
Because we still use stones, right? As far back as that Stone Age, people still use stone at some kind of tools. So I don't think books, the physical books with its pages will ever go
away.
Yes,
by the way, the feel of it and the smell of a new...
We just have more technology at our beck and call, but that doesn't mean... We will get rid of books.
So for you to say that a book can't just be replaced by something electronic means a lot.
Yeah, I mean you can still have both form. I mean, I live in a very modern condo now that doesn't have a lot of space for books. And that's my regret.
Yes.
You know, and so I have to put away a lot of books that I like because I have too many books. But on the other hand... I don't see it's either or. I will, you know, there are books that I need to know or read, but I don't necessarily love. And there are books that that I constantly come back and touch it and read passages from it. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I think it's not either or.
Even though books like the ones you've written, stories, are so clearly love letters, if they were handwritten and sent to somebody, they would be, most of them, just qualify... As a love letter, because they're all about other people's wonderful qualities.
Yeah, Yeah, and characters.
Yes.
And so,
and but you're in a book, and your handwriting isn't in here. I'm just thinking that for authors, when you send a book to somebody, to write a little something in your handwriting on that first page, and no love letter has to be long.
Yeah.
Just something. Because, handwriting is just king. Anne Mahoney, who's a handwriting analyst, was a guest here recently.
Yeah.
And the things she says about handwriting,
I
don't know if you know her. You should meet her. Everybody should meet Anne Mahoney. So interesting.
Huh.
That, because I have about four different handwritings.
Yeah.
Well, depending on what mood.
Sure.
I said, so.
Because there's relic. I mean, and there is a feel of a personal touch.
She will see the same person in each of those. You can't disguise who you are, even
from
though
the writing. Well,
your writing is so intrinsically a part of you.
With your personality, it's so interesting. I bought years ago. I bought a used book by James Baldwin, but when I opened it, it was like for $3. But when I opened it, there is this handwriting, and he was writing it to a friend.
Oh my goodness!
And so it just felt very, very special.
So
to have
it
a
was
book.
He had written in it.
He had written it to a friend.
Yes.
Like, here's to so and so. You know, hope you enjoyed it. Something like just very simple sentence, but by James Baldwin.
Yes.
You know, and suddenly.
But even if it's in a stranger's handwriting, you know, to Odie with love from Sarah.
Yeah.
I mean, you're seeing somebody lived here, left a mark.
Sure.
Oh, thank you for doing this with me. It's so good to talk to you and just listen to what you're doing.
Yeah.
And. Please remember that no matter what you do in life, you can turn it into a love letter.
Sure.
Just by some note from your heart. And it doesn't even matter what it is, because what comes from the heart reaches the heart.
Sure. If you write with love, it is a love letter.
Yes. Well, thank you, dear. I appreciate this a lot. And do you want to give us the website for your business?
Oh, please. It's called newamericamedia.org, and you can find a lot of
newamericamedia.org.
That's right.
I have to spell it out, because if you're one letter off, you're lost in some kind of mystery goo. Well, thank you.
Thank you
so much. And I hope you'll come back and talk to us again.
Next book.
Anytime you have something to say.
Okay.
Thank you so much. This is Janet Gallen saying goodbye for now.